The following audio is brought to you by Emmanuel Baptist Church in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. More information about our church can be found at emmanueltuscaloosa.org.
Okay, so just to some extent, a summary of where we've been, where we were last week, just to kind of help maybe set the framework for what we're doing when we study apologetics and what we're saying and what we're not saying. You understand that there are many people that are not necessarily diametrically opposed to God. I'm not thinking about the person that where you would go to their doorstep and say, I'm here as a representative of Emmanuel Baptist Church, and I want to share the gospel of the good news of Jesus Christ with you, and they start throwing things at you and yelling obscenities and slam the door. I'm not thinking about that person primarily, but more a person who is open to a discussion about the possibility of God's existence. And what's helpful is that apologetics can be a tool that you use to really open someone's mind to the possibility of faith. That it's possible that there are people who are right now in unbelief, that the idea of God's existence is not something they're opposed to, but they just don't see how it can logically work. Maybe they think that it's an idiot's argument for existence or something like that. And potentially some apologetic arguments might be able to help them see that what we believe is not merely something that we just take on faith, that's it, that's the end of it. We really don't want to be Christians that say, you just take it on faith. Everything is just on faith. Because that's not really true. We don't actually believe that. What we actually believe is that God has given us very rational reasons for believing in his existence, for one, for establishing credibility in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which we'll get to in some weeks, becomes the center point of everything we're arguing about is the resurrection. If the resurrection didn't happen, it doesn't matter about any of the rest of this stuff. But because the resurrection happened, because we can pinpoint a day and time, or at least a time period where Jesus rose from the dead, and the credibility of all the witnesses that gave testimony to his resurrection, because we can pinpoint that, all of these other things become now logically possible and worth arguing for. And so when we sit down at the coffee table with someone, we're not just arguing for a position that we have just woken up one day and said, I think I want to believe this, and I'm just going to take everything on faith. But we actually have come to really truly believe that there is a very real being that we refer to as God, who is Yahweh in the Old Testament, who's called himself by name. We believe that he has revealed himself to us, that he stands behind, in, and through all of creation, making it and upholding it by the word of his power. And so we believe that rationally. There are real reasons why we believe that that happened. We don't just take everything on faith. But then also, there are aspects of our life as Christians that is faith. We believe that God will be true to his promises, as an example of that, right? I don't necessarily have something in my hand that says here is the deed that I can show you that he will return. I do have some measure of faith that I believe he's going to return, and lots of reasons for that. But my point is that our faith isn't divorced from reason. They work together. They're friends. They help one another. And so when you sit down with rational arguments for the existence of God, it can open someone's mind to the possibility of faith, clearing roadblocks and things that would otherwise prevent them from believing. And so, to be clear what we're doing, arguments for God's existence, they're not attempting to kind of, give a scientific proof, which is what so many want. And if you just pay attention, if you just listen to a couple of maybe secular people arguing about whether or not God exists, what you'll find more often than not is what they're wanting is scientific proof that God exists. I mean, really, when you get down to it, if you hear the arguments of, say, Richard Dawkins, who is probably the leading atheist in the world, although he called himself a cultural Christian the other day, and I was like, my jaw hit the floor. I was like, what? But anyway, so he's like the world's leading atheist probably right now. And but he's getting closer to his deathbed. So I wouldn't be surprised for him to become more of a cultural Christian the closer he gets to his deathbed. but I digress. You know, so when he argues against the existence of God, what he often demands is some sort of scientific evidence for God like you could find in a laboratory. And that's not the kind of proof that apologetics is here really to offer. And as you'll see this morning, really what apologetics is designed to do is to confront us with the radical insufficiency of what is finite and limited, okay? So I realize that that's a whole bunch of words right there all at one time. But if you think about what that means, we're saying what is here, what is finite, is insufficient to explain all of this. It can't. At some point, it just doesn't work. So when we look at the arguments that I'm going to put before you today, I wanted to start with a couple of the easier ones. Now, I understand that it's not, you know, it's not the same thing as, you know, elementary math or something like that, you know. But they are easy ones, and I feel like they're easy because you've actually used them before. You have used these arguments for God's existence, and you probably didn't even know where they came from. I don't know where you got them. Maybe you heard them from somebody else, and you thought, well, that was a really good argument, and I'll use that one. But these arguments, though they're complex and, you know, there's a lot of parts to them, they're still things that you've actually used before, you've thought through before, you understand. We're going to understand them on a philosophical level, but you've used them before. And they come from Thomas Aquinas. And here's what I want you to understand. What we're going to do today is not prove Yahweh in the Old Testament exists and sent his son to die for our sins. That's not what we're establishing. All we're establishing is the possibility, the logical probability, maybe even the logical mandate, that a being exists outside of what we see, what we know and see. Okay? That's it. So the bar is really low. If you're sitting at a coffee table with somebody who is an atheist and you get them to this point, you have moved the needle for sure, but we're still a far cry from Christianity. Okay? Does that make sense? So we're the bar is really low for right now. But both of these arguments come from Thomas Aquinas, and they're very similar to one another. And so at the end, I'm gonna point out just the fine differences between the two. But the first is the argument from change. This comes from Thomas Aquinas. You've actually used this before, so let's think about how this argument works. The material world is defined by change, and that is evident in growth and transformation from state to state. So you could think of something like an oak tree. An oak tree doesn't start off an oak tree. It starts off as what? A little acorn. And that acorn then grows, becomes a sapling, becomes a eventually 20, 30 years later, it's this massive oak tree. Or perhaps you could think of something like something we all love, cookies. Okay, cookies these have lots of gluten in them. So I'm sorry, I don't want to trigger anybody in here, but they're not gluten free. All right, so they're sitting on our counter. Chocolate chip cookies, but you intuitively know those chocolate chip cookies didn't just start that way. They actually became that way through change. They started off as butter, flour, sugar, things like that. Now, when something comes to be in a certain state, when it comes to be that cookie, that state, we understand, can't bring itself into being, right? That cookie didn't just poof out of nowhere. It didn't just create itself. It didn't just come into being. Until it comes to be a cookie, it doesn't even exist as a cookie. As an example, if you came over to my house and I said, do you want some cookies? And you said, yes, I'd love some cookies. And I put a plate of flour and butter and sugar and chocolate chips in front of you and said, eat up. You would say, I wanted cookies. Cookies don't exist on this plate right now. What exists on this plate is butter and flour and sugar and a bunch of other things. So if it doesn't exist, if the cookie doesn't exist, it can't cause anything, right? That's pretty clear. The cookie can't cause you to be satisfied, can't cause delight in your heart by eating it, because it doesn't exist, right? You can't cram flour and sugar in there and hope it mixes together and makes a cookie in your mouth. It won't work. Okay, it doesn't cause anything to exist. So, as for the thing that changes, although it can be what it will become a cookie, it's not yet what it will become. So, the butter, the flour, and sugar can become a cookie, but it's not yet that. Is everybody tracking with me so far? Okay. It actually exists right now in this state, which is several ingredients, butter, flour, and sugar. So what we're establishing is that it has the potentiality to become a cookie. So think about what we've done so far in this sort of step through logic and reason. What Thomas Aquinas is laying out is that change doesn't exist inside the thing itself, right? It's not a natural consequence of being that you can change yourself. So you could do this with anything. A person starts off as a zygote inside the mother. An embryo, it grows into a 9-month in gestation. You can see the eyes and the fingers and the toes, and you can see everything about it. Where you would go, oh my God, I recognize a full-fledged human in there. But there were that wasn't just a natural consequence. Even though we might say, well, that's normal. That normally happens. There were still a ton of things had to be a part of the embryo's environment in order to make that thing happen, right? So it doesn't come within itself. It has the potentiality for that state, but it doesn't exist in that state right now, right? We're established so far. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay. Okay, good. Go ahead, James. You're not going to spoil it for everybody, are you? Okay, just kidding.
No, I'm just thinking about it. So they don't see this at this
pre-combined. Yes. So James says you can't get something from nothing, and that's true. And that's so. Like I was saying, you've used this argument before. This is more complex and drawn out, but you've essentially used this argument before when you say that. So essentially, here is the actual that's happened, is the butter, flour, sugar. There's the potential, is the cookies. And what's required to go from actual to potential is an element of change that takes place that doesn't exist within the cookie. And what we're going to find out doesn't even exist within the flour, sugar, and butter either, okay? So to go from actual to potential, there has to be change from the outside that takes place. So the way we say that is to explain the change, we have to consider not just the changing thing alone, not just the ingredients changing into a cookie, but that there are other things outside the changing thing that takes it from actual to the potential. So In other words, if I put the butter, flour, and sugar on the plate in front of you, and you said, well, there's no cookies here. And I said, well, just give it a minute. Would that suffice? Of course not. You know, there's got to be other things outside the butter, flour, sugar, and whatever other ingredients there are in order to produce the potential. Even the ingredients themselves cannot produce the change required to take it from actual to potential. Okay. So it has to be acted upon by other things outside the potential to be made actual. Otherwise, it cannot change. So if we were to depict this, we would say, not only does there have to be an actual with a potential in mind, but the thing that has to come in to bring about the change is an outside agent. So in this case, maybe a baker and a mixer and, you know, Emily. So yeah, I just, what? Do what? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I use this as an example because Emily apparently makes some Chick-fil-A cookies, Chick-fil-A copycat cookies that are supposed to be better than Chick-fil-A, and I've heard about them, but I've never actually tasted them. They how do we know? They exist right now in actual, but they require a change to become potential. In other words, you gotta drive them up to the office, man. This was all to bring about conviction. I'm just yeah, I mean, how do we know? I don't know. It just exists right now in theory. Yeah. I've been faithing hard. That was hilarious. Okay. Where were we? The actual has to be acted upon by things on the outside in order to produce what we know is potentially possible. In other words, nothing changes itself. That's essentially what Aquinas is doing, is working through this proof to demonstrate that it is very plain to see that nothing changes itself. As an example with the cookies or with anything else. By the way, I know some of you might take pictures of slides or whatever. If you want the slides, you can download them online too, and you'll have the slides. You holding up your phone made me think of that. Okay. Yes, this is all recorded on the website. Yeah, any building block that takes place here is on the website. So. And the slides as well, so anything you want can be downloaded there. You doing that made me think to tell you that, because you wouldn't know otherwise. I'm sure you don't just go to our website all the time. But here's the further complicating factor to this. Not only does a thing in its ingredients require an outside agent to change it in order to bring about the potential, that outside agent also has to be acted upon in order to bring about the change. So if we're just breaking this down little by little, you could do the same graph or graphic with the mixer. And you'd say there needs to be a power plant that burns coal or nuclear or whatever it is that produces the electricity to be supplied to the mixer. There needs to be a hand that plugs it in and turns the switch on and puts the ingredients in the bowl. But then if you were to go further into the hand that has to turn the mixer on, you would also have to find a mind there, a will, a fully functioning person there, someone who has the cognitive ability to do that. You couldn't do it, you couldn't have a baby there or somebody like that. And you could go on and on and on and on and on, and you would almost, for a while, never run out of things that would be required to be brought about by an agent of change to produce a potential outcome. Does that make sense? Because nothing changes itself. Not the person, not the mixer, not the ingredients, not the cookie. Okay. So since this is the case, all things stand in need right now of being acted upon by other things, or else they cannot change. So if you were to do this with an acorn, you would say soil, water, sunlight. It needs tons of things to be acted upon. But it doesn't just need to be acted upon, it needs to become an acorn first. So it needed an oak tree to begin with, right? That had to produce the acorn and so on and so forth. Everything needs something outside of itself to actualize its potentiality for change. Are there any questions about that? Go ahead. We're going to get there. Yeah. So this is what it might look like. You could go on forever and ever and ever, and you could continue to do these, and for everything that you came up with underneath flour, sugar, that needed to be supplied in order for the flour and sugar and whatever, you got to grow wheat and other, you'd have to have more things that would multiply underneath that until it would become, it would fill the slide with more information than you could possibly hold, right? Everything needs change. So, in other words, the universe, and by that we mean everything from matter, space, time, everything. What we see, what we don't see, that would be space, you know, time, whatever beings there are. The universe is the sum total of all these moving things, however many there are, but change in anything, in any element of the universe requires an outside force to actualize it. What that means then is that for the things to exist, it becomes logically necessary for something to be outside of that. So there has to be a force outside or in addition to the universe who is a real being and transcendent to the universe. And this being outside the universe is outside, must be logically necessary, outside matter, space, and time. It cannot be a changing thing. It has to be unchanging. And it has to be the source of change. Otherwise, nothing could exist. Okay, so Camille brings up a good point. Couldn't someone just say, God changes? If God changes, then he's not God. Because what we're saying is, there has to be something logically necessary in order for things to exist and change. There, if you follow that back all the way, you just keep going. So you take the cookie and the ingredients and you keep doing the chart and you keep spreading it out and you keep tracking and tracking and tracking and you do this for years and years and years, eventually you're going to get back to an unchanging thing. There has to be an unchanging thing. So what Aquinas has established here is not who that God is, right? He's only established that in order for things to actually change, when we observe change, in order for things to change, there has to ultimately be something outside of that, whether he started it in motion. This could be, so far he has not established any personal being just yet. He's only established there has to be a being that is outside, that requires no change in and of himself, in order to inaugurate the change, in order to initiate even the first change, right? To take it from ingredient to actual. There has to be, logically. Or else, nothing could come into existence. Because everything that we can anything that we know of requires something outside of it to change. So there has to be an originator of that change, is what he's saying.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, well, if we go to the Bible, we see some... Now, I'm not trying to argue that the book of James or that Malachi are, you know, using Aquinas' logic. They came before Aquinas. If anything, Aquinas might be borrowing some things from them. And they're probably not necessarily thinking about this, but it does shed maybe some light on these passages. James 1, 17 to 18. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. Of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. Or Malachi 3, 6. For I, the Lord, do not change. Therefore you, O children of Jacob, are not consumed. Regardless of whether or not Malachi or James are, you know, kind of early Thomas, I don't think they're necessarily making that kind of philosophical argument. But what they are establishing is that all of existence, any person, is built on the premise that God himself is unchanging. He sits outside of change. He sits outside of time and space and matter, in that he is unaffected by it, that he is the originator and the cause of all of those things. Are you tracking with the argument from change? Does it make sense? Go ahead. They do. So I would say, okay, the reason why, let me back up just one notch before your question. The reason why this argument is helpful for you today is because, and you have used this, I think, most of you probably have, is when you come to a notion like the Big Bang, you will ask the question, and what caused that? Well, so you see, there were these tiny particles that were there, and they existed. I don't care how small they were, but they existed in tiny little microscopic, you couldn't even see them. And they exploded and became, you know, now you can walk upright and vote. Like, that's basically cut out 13.7 billion years of time, and now you can walk and upright and vote and, you know, do all kinds of different things. And you ask the question, okay, but take a step back from that. What caused the change there? So let's say I grant your premise, okay? Because my argument right now, if we're talking at that level at the coffee table, my argument right now is not Jesus rose from the dead necessarily. My argument right now is, what caused that, right? So in answer to your question, I think they actually do. Because if pressed on that question, boy, do you get some explanations. Right now, very popular explanation, I'm not kidding you, you will hear this if you pay attention, we are living in a simulation. Have you heard this? Anybody heard this before? The notion being, we are... whatever you want to call it, actors, this is the Matrix. Basically, the ideas for creation came from the movie The Matrix, essentially, the modern ideas. I'm like, come on, we got better stuff than that. Something like that, this is the explanation, that there is a being outside of the computer simulation that has programmed this, and we are experiencing. I literally heard this yesterday. And that they programmed this, and we are actors, or, you know, computer-generated whatever, in that computer simulation. And then the question then is, who is that that caused that? And so I think, actually, As much as we want to roll our eyes at the computer simulation idea, I think that's actually a step closer to theism than further away than we were before, okay? And I think now we're getting to, okay, so let's play this out just a little bit further. Who is that? And now the explanations become an alien race. You can see their spaceships are now, we're getting pictures of these in the sky, and pilots are seeing these flying here and there. And there's all kinds of, all kinds of explanations. I saw a documentary one time, not to say that this is the be-all and end-all of truth, from a theist, Ben Stein. You remember this? Did anybody see this? Expelled, I think, is the documentary. It's pretty old. It's probably 20 years old. But he goes around and he talks to some leading scientific or science professors at universities and things like that, and asks them this question. Okay, then the Big Bang. So then where did that come from? There's explanations like, well, it came on the backs of crystals, and they really get out there. And then you go, okay, well, where did that come from? What caused that? What caused that? What caused that? So my point is, you've used this, and I think that other people, when they are pressed with that question, they feel forced to have to then come up with an explanation for that. And if you keep pressing and keep pressing and keep pressing, eventually they're either going to say, wow, perhaps some intelligent mind behind it, or they're going to say, well, it's just always been. And that's just it. But the point that Aquinas is making is that logically does not work. And it doesn't satisfy anyone. And you're only playing games with yourself if you think that is actually an answer to existence. Because it doesn't satisfy anyone's imaginations or curiosities to hear that, well, it's just always been. And that's just the way it is. Stop asking questions. Right? There's still something that wants you to go, yeah, but what caused that? Right? Go ahead, Timothy. Yeah, there's a reason nations are called beasts in the Bible. Because of that reason. Any other questions so far? Just the argument from change. So I want to just, let's just set in our minds what Aquinas is just attempting to do. He's looking at one aspect of the known world, the element of change. And he's saying from that aspect, I can trace back to a reason for which God must exist. There must be something outside that, right? So he's picked the element of change and he's worked his way back. So now he does the same thing, but from the element of causality. That thing, the element of existence, in other words. Something comes into existence. These are the first two of what is known as Thomas Aquinas' five ways. Or five proofs for the existence of God. So these are the first two. This is the argument from efficient causality. And it's going to be very similar to the one we just saw, except that Aquinas is now picking out a different observation that things come to exist. Not just that they change, but that they come to exist. So we commonly observe one thing causing another thing to exist. So an example of this would be there's a piano in the room and music fills the room. You're not around the piano, you don't have sight of the piano, but you hear the music being played. Intuitively, you know that the music didn't bring itself about, but that someone sat down and caused the music to exist in the room. And not only that, but without someone causing that to exist, or if someone stopped causing that to exist. In other words, without those relationships of causality, without those causal relationships, then things would not come into existence or they would not continue to exist. So in other words, I will hear that music being played, but the moment I hear the music stop, what am I to assume? Peter, in this example, got up from the piano bench and walked away from the piano. He's no longer playing, or else the music would continue to fill up the room. So if Peter stops playing the piano, the music also stops. So the next step from that is, logically, Something cannot cause its own existence before it exists. The piano cannot cause music to come from it before it exists. It has to exist first, and it has to be caused to exist first before it can cause music to exist. Peter cannot produce music from the piano before he exists. Something has to cause Peter to exist before he can cause music to exist. Again, just like the graph we saw in the previous argument, we get to the same thing here. It cannot cause something to exist before it exists. That's nonsensical. So anything that comes into existence has to be brought about by something other than itself, since it cannot be its own cause. Okay, so far, we tracking? Yeah. When you walk on the beach and you see a sandcastle there, you don't go, man, the waves just have been doing a real work today. They crashed into the ocean or crashed into the beach and look at what they assembled here. You assume that something caused this sandcastle to exist because it cannot just come into existence on its own. That's nonsensical. Okay. So that means that every existing entity, whatever that may be, is contingent on something else for its existence. It didn't bring itself into being. And this is a logical overflow. This is a logical next step from the principle that nothing can cause or can self-cause its existence. It's necessary that there be an external cause for every existing thing that brought that thing into existence. So, it's impossible then for a chain of causes of this kind to go on to infinity, that they just keep going. So, an example might be something like this. If you walked up on a falling row of dominoes, you saw all the dominoes falling, even if you could not see its beginning, you would naturally have to conclude that there was an original domino that started the falling of the dominoes. If I told you there's not an original domino, there was not an original domino, then the dominoes wouldn't be falling because there wasn't an original one to set the dominoes in motion. Nothing can cause its own existence. Therefore, if nothing was there to cause the existence, then the dominoes wouldn't fall. So what that means then, the same way we got to the argument from change, if there is no God who has existence by his own eternal nature, then the gift of existence cannot be passed down the chain of creatures, and we can never get it. But you see, what Aquinas observes is we do get it. We exist. We're here. And so therefore, there must exist a God who is, by definition, an uncaused being who does not receive existence like us and like every other link in the chain of receivers. Everything we can go through, all the way back to the beginning, had to come about by some external cause. So then it's necessary that there exists something outside that chain that caused it all. Even if, so right now we're not going further into that argument, we're saying, we're giving a theistic evolution guy who believes that, you know, believes the Big Bang, believes the 13.7 billion years or whatever, believes everything, evolution, believes all of that, but believes there was a God that caused it. He would be welcome in this argument right now, right? So we haven't gone further into arguing for Christianity. We've simply argued for some sort of intelligent being outside of the created order. It's what Aquinas is establishing is that is logically necessary for any of this to actually be in place. If it's not, nothing could exist because nothing can cause its own existence. And if you say, well, God caused his own existence. Okay, well, he's the beginning then, right? He's at the beginning of this thing. He's uncaused, and he doesn't receive existence like us, but has handed down this chain of existence to us. So a couple of passages that sort of reiterate this same idea. John 1:3, all things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. Or Psalm 90, verse 2, goes back into the Old Testament. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. So even the Bible is recognizing, perhaps not necessarily, you know, Aquinas' exact logic and reason here, but they're arguing for the same essential premise, that God is from everlasting to everlasting, that all things that have existence owe their existence to one uncaused being who sits outside of time and space that brought all of these things about. Do you see the logical chain that he's establishing here? Right? And so, essentially, he's laying out what we talked about last week, which is, if premise one, and premise two, and premise three, and premise four are all true, then conclusion five has to be true. So, due to logic and reason, if you can't eliminate the premise, and you have to grant the premise, then you also have to grant the conclusion, necessarily. All right, that's all he's establishing. So, any questions about that? Have you used these before? I mean, maybe they were rudimentary or something like that. I don't know, but have you ever used something like this before? How did it go? It didn't go. Go ahead, Timothy. Yeah, well, like what we said last week, right? So if you're staring down the barrel of logic and reason, and the premises are granted, but the conclusion is not granted, like what Timothy brings up. Sin enters the fray, the devil himself blinds the mind of the unbelieving, their own flesh, whatever you want to call it, spiritual blindness of some kind, is there in that conversation. And they say, no, I don't agree with your conclusion, though I can't refute your premises. Then essentially what's being said to you is, I understand that the world that I'm living in right now, in my own head, is illogical. But I simply don't want to live in the world that you have constructed. Okay, here's the deal with that. And this is why that's really important. And again, to reiterate what we talked about last week, this is the ultimate goal of apologetics. It is not to merely argue for the existence of God, but to expose the real conversation that's going on at the coffee table. Because the real conversation is not really about God's existence, because as Kendall brings up, everybody's going to get to the point, even with evolution as it exists right now, Darwinian evolution is probably the prevailing theory for how things came into existence today, right? In the broad world out there. Even with that theory, if you start pushing any individual who is an ardent defender of that theory, eventually they're going to get uncomfortable. Because there are unsettled questions, no matter how deeply those things are buried, there are still unsettled questions about how did that happen? Yeah, but who caused that? But how did that come into existence? That they have simply either suppressed by their rejection of God, or they don't want to ask the question because they're afraid of the answer. So apologetics is really designed to scrape away all the scaffolding that has been built up around their ideas and bring them down to its bare bones and say, yeah, but what caused that? But where did that come from? And now we get into the conversation of, I understand where your logic is taking you, and I understand the things that you've established, and no, I can't refute any of the things that you've said, but I disagree with your premise, your conclusion. Which basically says, I understand that you have put forward a creative, intelligent mind. You haven't even told me who that mind is or what he does or anything about him. But I understand that there is a creative mind. And if there is a creative being outside of space and time, then I owe my allegiance to him. I owe my existence to him. And I'm responsible. I've got to answer to him. And now we're at the real conversation. The real conversation is there are two ways to live, and I don't want to submit to your way of living. Right? Which is the premise of the track. Myra. I mean, I'm sure. I mean, it depends on who you're talking to. You know, but there's all kinds of things within that. I know of a person right now who is, it's not that they don't want to believe, it's that they know what that's going to cost them if they do believe. And they're very open and honest about saying, I know what it's going to cost me, and I'm unsure if I can pay that cost, if I want to take that cost on. You know, so there was a man in a Tibetan man in China that we shared the gospel with who had the exact same response. He literally used the phrase count the cost. And he said to us, if I believe this, which I understand what you're telling me, and I want to believe it, but if I follow this Jesus that you're telling me about, then I have to go home to Tibet and be rejected by every single member of my family and have absolutely no support structure. So he said, I have to count the cost to see if it's worth it, right? So, but now you understand that we're arguing for worth, for the worth of Christ, for the value of the church body. But the reason that a church is so important, this is the reason why in Acts you see the apostles preaching and everybody's giving of their stuff to make sure that there's nobody in need and that there is a support structure around them. The reason why they're doing that is because everybody that is following Christ is losing every member of their family. Like that guy in Tibet or the guy that I'm talking to, he's every single one of them are losing people around them. They have zero support structure now. Some of them are getting fired from their jobs. A host of things are happening to these people, and the church body around them is that net, that family that is coming in around them to say, we are going to help you carry this load. Whether it's the burdens of sin or the burdens of faith or even just financial burdens. We're going to sell our property if we have to, and we'll give to the church so that everybody will have what they need. Yeah, if you can imagine a person, a young person, let's say, who's drinking and carousing every weekend and having, promiscuous sex and all these kinds of things, you share Christ with them, and they understand that. But all the people that they've come to know that support the lifestyle that they've grown accustomed to, they're going to have to abandon. So, but my point is that these arguments, remember, these are not ends in and of themselves. This is not this is really not a weapon. It's more of a tool than anything else. And so it's not as though I'm attempting to kill somebody with it or to win an argument or to say, ha-ha, I've defeated you or anything like that. This is merely to expose what's really happening underneath. And underneath, we have a submission issue, or we have a host of issues. Counting the cost issue is what we've talked about now. But it could be a number of different things that are our response to that. But my point is, this gets us to that. That's what we want. That's the real conversation that we're after. Yeah. 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 And far more people are considering Christ, responding to Christ, than you think they are. Right now, you may sit there and you may think, well, if I shared the gospel with somebody, they don't want to hear that. They're going to respond to me like I hear people responding, when I look at some news article online that showed some guy getting really upset about it and throwing stuff at the guy that shared the gospel or something like that. And that's simply not true. It may happen to you. I can't promise that it won't, right? But far more frequently, somebody might say, no thanks. Or they might say, I'd be interested to have a conversation about that and talk with you. And so you think it might not be possible, but I promise you, if you said, can I share something with you? Or would you be open to having a conversation about God? You'd be amazed at how many people would say, sure. So even in your workplace, particularly with people you know, just ask them if they'd be interested. I guarantee you get a lot of yeses. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's pray and then be dismissed. Heavenly Father, we're grateful for your word. We're grateful for people like Thomas Aquinas who took time to think through logical defenses that we could still even use today and employ and do every day and that are helpful for us. So I pray that this course be just that helpful, that we be able to look through some of these arguments and present a well-reasoned defense for the hope that is within us. So give us that. Help us to grow our minds and even our love for other people, our compassion for other people, to be willing to engage in difficult conversations and conversations we're not really even good at, in order to help them see their need for you and the fact that we owe even our very existence to you and your will. So we pray that you would do that in us and give us that kind of hope and assurance, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks for listening. If you live in the Tuscaloosa area and are looking for a church, we'd love for you to visit. Our service times are Sunday mornings at 10:30 and Wednesday nights at 6:15.